Hello, my name is Thomas, and welcome to this episode of British Culture, Albion Never Dies. In this episode, I interview Chris Hunt, who is known on Instagram as British Bond Addict. He and I work together to identify the seven pillars of Britishness. Listen and enjoy. Okay, Chris, thank you very, very much for joining me. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Hey, I'm Chris. I am a avid Britisher, I guess we'll call it that. I've lived in Britain my entire life. I'm currently a primary school teacher. I currently run an Instagram site related to James Bond paraphernalia and obsessions, essentially. And that's how I've managed to get in touch with Thomas. Yeah, we met up on a few events quite a while ago. And yeah. That's what I've been doing at the moment, basically. It's my way of dealing with lockdown, is now being very British and talking about James Bond a lot.
And your Instagram handle is British Bond Fan, right?
British Bond Addict, yes.
Sorry.
That's all right.
Cut that bit out. So so tell me, as you are a British Bond addict, can you tell me what is Britishness?
Britishness is a really weird one. I've been thinking about it a lot since you posed the question before coming on with the podcast. And of course, there's a cynical view, which is being British is driving a German car, watching American TV and eating Italian food, which kind of sums it up in a little bit, because I feel like being British is something that no one deliberately tries to do. But you can always spot the British person when you go on holiday. Like, they always stand out. It's never intentional, I'm sure. I think to me personally, it's about the culture, and it's about not necessarily a sense of pride or national pride, but just being happy to have conversations about being British or just standing out. Like when I went to university, I went to a very diverse university, and lots of people were just fascinated by British culture, which is strange because I really didn't feel like the British had too much of a standout culture in comparison to other European countries. I think for me personally, being British is just carrying it around with you without even actually necessarily being aware that you're doing it.
Fair enough. I'm really interested in that idea. You said that you felt the other European countries had a really strong culture and that we didn't. Can you tell me a bit more about that?
It's quite an interesting one. Like, obviously, being in Britain, you kind of get used to all the British aspects, so you don't even notice that they're happening, essentially. But, like, I feel like most of the things that stand out from British culture aren't really that big. And I think, like, when you go to Italy and you think of, like, you know, Italian, the look of Italian cities, the taste of Italian food, the personality of Italian people, I think stands out is much more interesting than possibly British food or British culture, or possibly like some of the buildings, some of the standout bits of that. When people think Britain, people think, you know, Big Ben, they think the Tower of Parliament, all that sort of thing. I don't know why. I don't know if it's because I'm so used to it. It just doesn't seem particularly interesting or fascinating in a way. Like, I'm much more keen to go and visit other countries, even though I don't really live in London. I don't really live where the big landmarks are. It's interesting. It's such a strange one. I don't know if it's because if it's been watered down, I'm so used to it now.
Fair enough. And it is interesting, you often discover what is Britishness by discovering what Britishness isn't.
Yes.
So when I was at university, I was working with the international students, and they were all talking about taps, and I never thought twice about taps in the UK. But it was the idea that in the UK we often have two taps, one too hot and one too cold. And I didn't realize how unusual this is in the whole world, that the whole world seems to have mixie taps. But in the UK, it seems that we all like having two taps. And it's something I'd never think about, except that I've come across people who think it's weird and mad.
Yeah. Well, quite an interesting thing. I've made friends with quite a few Americans since I joined the Instagram game. And there's so many standout differences there from two very similar cultures, essentially. Like, I know, obviously, there's quite a gulf between the Americans and British, the Americans and the Brits. But so many different things, like different foods that we've now acquired. Like, for the first time recently, I tried a peanut butter and jelly sandwich.
Okay.
Which is, frankly, one of the most un-British things I think I've ever done.
Oh, is it?
Oh, yeah. It's such a bizarre concept. And of course, I even called it peanut butter and jelly because I get mocked if I call it peanut butter and jam.
Oh, right. I must admit, I've been doing that since I was a child. But then we came across Americans when I was a child. I wonder if I picked up the habit there.
Oh, really?
I didn't realise this was an un-British thing. Marmite seems to be a very British thing.
Marmite's very British. Marmalade. And if it's bitter in one flavour, that's normally the way it goes.
Like our sense of humour, if our sense of humour is bitter.
Actually, that's one thing. That's one thing that defines being British to me, is self-deprecation. Like, no one can do self-deprecation as well as the Brits can, or as badly as the Brits can. It's such a strange one, because actually humour, I think, is a huge part of the British culture, because we have a very standout, dry sense of humour, as I'm sure you're aware. And I think it's something that it does define us to a level. We're kind of expected to not be necessarily, you know, cracking jokes every 5 seconds, but we are expected to have some sort of like British wit in there somewhere. And it's very distinctive. Like, it's very interesting meeting people. Well, say my majority of my friends have exactly the same level of wit as I do, and exactly the same style of humour.
Yeah, it is interesting. Humour is one of the most culturally specific things that, even with the same language, you know, UK to US, comedy can hit very, very differently within the two countries, or even within the same country, right?
It's a strange one. There's sometimes where it works, which is why Hollywood and Britain, they can kind of meld together there. But it's almost now like they actually try and mix the humours deliberately. If you see like some sort of action film or some sort of comedy film, if there's an American or a Brit, that's normally one of the best combinations to go for, is having like the fast, quick-witted American and then the dry British wit afterwards. It's an interesting mix, and it's someone that's been picked up quite a bit, and I've started to notice recently. They love mixing those two parts of the culture together.
Yeah, well, that is interesting. Which films have you specifically noticed that in? I'm curious.
Quite a few, like I've noticed it in Mission Impossible films, like they have Simon Pegg and Tom Cruise together. Oh. And I've noticed it quite a bit in TV, even from back from the 70s, old TV show called UFO, set in Britain. The lead was Ed Bishop, very fast talking American, and then he was sidled up with, oh gosh, I've forgotten his name now, blast. George Sewell, there we go. And yes, even back then, the whole American-British thing, they're talking about it in a documentary, it's kind of a natural partnership. They don't really need to work on something because the two mixtures work quite so well together. And yet they're so different, and the personalities are so different, it makes it more interesting to watch, bizarrely, because if you had two characters who are exactly the same doing the same thing all the time, it might just be get a bit boring after a while. But actually, it kind of almost makes banter in itself. It makes camaraderie by having two such close differences.
Fair enough. It's always good to have a double act with a contrast, right?
Exactly. Yeah, absolutely.
So I'm wondering, if we're talking about dry wit, I guess James Bond is kind of famous for his dry one-liners.
Yeah, dry one-liners and puns. I think people definitely focus on the puns more. It's an interesting one. It's always making light in quite a dire situation, to be completely honest, in most of the films. If we go from the first one, Dr. No, for example, after the hearse, which is chasing James Bond, barrels over a cliff and explodes in flames, just to say, oh, I think they're on the way to a funeral. Like, in reality, you'd be like, dude, calm down. But yes, I find that kind of thing
very wartime. That kind of humour seems like a very much a wartime humour that's carried on.
Yes, yeah, there's definitely been lots of instances of British people in war finding the humour in some aspects. Because it's such a good coping mechanism, really, isn't it? To bring that sort of humour into a situation where it is so dire overall. And we're seeing a bit of it now in lockdown. Of course, everyone's not having a particularly great time of it at the moment. But it is making some fascinating TV shows, because they are just using humour to get us through the situation. One is Staged, which is basically just about Zoom calls. And it's funny because it hits so close to home, and it's so like on the nose of how bad everything is. You can't help but laugh. And that's something I think the British have always been able to do, is make the light in a terrible situation. Yeah.
Fair enough. And yeah,
but also, I think what's useful is actually sometimes it comes across as charming, which is very lucky, because normally self-deprecation is just because we're trying to make a joke.
Okay, so it seems that we've identified one standout characteristic of Britishness, which is sense of humour.
Sense of humour, yes. Well, it's an interesting one actually as well. There's a recent political thing. I'm not going to drop the name because I hate to talk about politics. But they're talking about somebody that British people weren't exactly enjoying or getting along with. And it's just because the individual didn't have a sense of humour. And it's weird how people were picking up on that almost subconsciously. So I think, yeah, to pinpoint a pillar of Britishness, sense of humour definitely has to be in there.
Right. That's one pillar. If that's number one, what's the number two pillar of Britishness?
I think there's, you know, the whole stiff upper lip sort of thing. Something I've discovered recently is how much, in comparison to lots of other cultures, how tight-lipped British people can actually be, and how little sometimes they share. And I've noticed a few examples of people who I don't know particularly well, and going into great detail, sharing lots of stories about things that I would like. I felt absolutely comfortable talking about it, of course, but it wouldn't necessarily come across my mind to have had those conversations. And there's always been the going back to the wartime thing, the stiff upper lip, all that sort of thing. I think that's something subconsciously quite a few British people have. I don't know how it's integrated, because as a primary school teacher, I see kids from a young age, and we're always talking about mental well-being and sharing and happiness. So I have no idea how it factors in. What do you think about that?
You get it from the environment, right? It's the dumb thing. They just do what all the adults do. You do what everyone does.
Yeah. I don't know if it's, I don't know if it's like trying to be polite in a sort of way, but it's strange how it's how it consistently picks up.
I was interested. I was talking to a Russian recently about, you know, some people see Russians as very cold and unfriendly, but most of my adult life have had very close Russian friends who I found very, very warm. But what they often say is that when you meet somebody for the first time, you don't put all your emotions out there, because it's kind of rude. You're imposing on their, like, their personal space. You have to wait until you get to know them. And so when they come across some people from some cultures where perhaps they're more willing to be more open, kind of earlier, they can just find it a little bit rude and uncomfortable. So I wonder if English people, like, and I've known people who've gone to study in the UK, and they said everyone is super polite, but nobody's warm. So they're kind of puzzling, how do you get a British person to be warm? Because they can see it between two British people, but sometimes they can't get to it themselves. And again, it's like you just have to get to know people before you get to that level of sharing.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. It's what I found as well, getting British people to be warm, it actually changes a lot depending on where in the UK you are. When I went to university, I met some very good friends from Hull, and they were complaining that people in, like, you know, south of England were rude, and I'd never come across that myself at all. And of course, we eventually went up and visited Hull, and yeah, it's a lot friendlier there. I'm not particularly sure how it works. So yeah, it may be culturally, certain parts of the UK are actually just a bit more friendly than others as well. I can imagine London, for example. I can imagine London would be particularly cold. Like, if you're busy, bustling city, lots of people there. It's a strange one. But yeah, I found lots of people in the north definitely think the southerners are much more cold.
Can confirm my earliest memories in the north of England, that I went to university in the north. And most of my time in the UK has been in very rural places. So if I go to what I consider the south, it's generally been to London first. And that makes a really strong impression. I'm sure the whole of the south of England isn't like it.
No.
It seems to be something of an anomaly generally. Somebody I was visiting in London got super embarrassed, because as I got off the bus, I said thank you to the bus driver. And I was thinking, gosh, it's completely the other way around. In most places I've lived, you always say thank you to the bus driver as you get off. So little things like that stay with you.
Yeah, it's quite a strange. Like, I'm quite south-based overall, essentially. And I'm used to much more country life than I am to cities and towns. And you do pick up on it the further away you get from a city. But it's interesting how sometimes it changes. Like, pubs in London, they'll always be happy to have new people in. While down in real rural South, you get local pubs with local people. And you're sort of, you walk in, everyone turns around, and you're immediately like, oh, okay, I know what pub I've walked into now. And you eventually get used to combating it. But it's a strange one how just little bubbles of it pop up, essentially.
It is. So even when we talk about what is Britishness, we suddenly pretty quickly start to zone in on the different areas of the UK. Like, gosh, an American friend of mine was talking about how he had a relative who was close by, so he drove for 2 hours to see them. And the Brit and I just locked eye contact, and we were like, driving 2 hours, if you drive 2 hours in the UK, the accent changes 3 times. The word for bread probably changes 6 times.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, it's a strange one, actually. It's a bit about going back to the Americans. We'll have to do a subsection about the American bits after this. It's put into perspective quite how small this little island is. And I've never been to Scotland. I've always wanted to go. And I've always been like, oh, you know, one day I'll go, that sort of thing. And then listening to people saying, like, oh, yeah, sometimes I drive, you know, 10 hours down the road just to see family. 10 hours, I could be in Scotland, like, in 4. So I think after the lockdown's done, I'm just going to get in my car and just do a drive to Scotland just because I can now, because it's strange quite how small Britain really is. And as you say, the dialect changes so frequently and in such a huge way. Like, a thick northern accent as opposed to a thick southern accent, is the difference is insane.
Yeah. I mean, I once met a man from Leeds, and pretty quickly within, hello, how are you, where are you from, oh, I'm from Leeds, I couldn't help asking, are you from the south of the city? Because I know in the north of the city, they have a much more standardized accent than the south. It's what you think of as a Yorkshire accent. So he was shocked. But the people around us were not British, and they were absolutely shocked. How can you tell north and south of a city?
Yeah, it's a fascinating one. It's weird because it's, as you said, such a small distance. It's so intriguing. And like, and then even with a Welsh accent as well, which is so standout. And of course, North Welsh accent, South Welsh accent. And again, it's such a tiny distance overall. It's so bizarre.
It is. I mean, it was Al Murray who said that you can't judge people by how they look, but you can judge them by how they sound.
Yeah. Well, it's an interesting one. It's interesting talking to people about the British accent, because there's always one, they always have the stereotypical British accent in their head, which I say is probably similar to mine and to ours. Because I've got a very, I feel like I've got a very neutral accent. It's kind of almost posh sounding, I've been told in some instances. But then I've been so tempted to be like, oh, well, take a listen to a Birmingham accent and see the comparison there, because it's so massive.
Yeah.
So yeah. I think a pillar will probably be just embracing different accents and being very proud of your own particular accent too.
Ah, that's a good one. Yeah. Mm. Of course, Bond's had a few different accents in the films. Obviously, the Scottish one is one a lot of people think of.
Yes.
And Moore's is totally different.
Yeah, it's an interesting one, actually. Yeah, because the accents overall, you've got Sean Connery's, which is probably the most mimicked, to be completely honest. That's the one that everyone goes for. You've got the very suave Roger Moore, got the kind of northern sounding Tim Dalton in some aspects. There's quite a few. Like, one of the big things is pronunciation of, like, grass and bath, that sort of thing. And Dalton had a very Bath and Grass pronunciation. So, the mix-up's quite interesting overall. And then you've got Craig as well, who's kind of got a very, very neutral accent too. Like, I can't really pinpoint bits of that. But yeah, so that's been changing a lot. But yeah, it's interesting. There's always been, like, jokes and parodies of getting, like, a true Northern Bond or that sort of thing. I think he is normally stereotypically Southern. I think he's written as... Actually, he's written with a Scottish background after matching Secret Service, so it's a huge mix-up there.
But he went to Eton, and obviously if you're from a Scottish background that wealthy, you tend to have a pretty standardised accent if you listen to the Scots Guards and so on.
Absolutely.
You wouldn't hear too much of that Scottish, full-on Scottish voice, because obviously the Scots are the same rich tapestry of accents that we have in England as well.
Yes, the variety there is outstanding.
Oh, I remember going up to the Orkneys. That was a tough accent for me. I think they put it on specially to fox me.
I have noticed sometimes when people are talking to someone who's got a different accent, and they sometimes go a little bit stronger. And again, they also, like you say, different words for bread or for rolls. Like, that becomes such an element of pride. There's no, we say baps here. Like, and if anybody says
you say baps,
they're wrong.
Fantastic.
Yeah. Oh, that's the thing. When the girl from Hull was adamant that they are bread cakes, I was like, what are you talking about? It's a bap. And that's always a source of, like, mild tension. It always starts off as, like, a nice, pleasant conversation. And by the end, you're like, okay, let's just agree to disagree, because this is getting us in a tizzy now.
Talking of controversial things, S-C-O-N-E. How do you say it?
I say scone.
Okay. Okay.
Majority of people say scone.
Ah, that's interesting. I've caught myself saying both at different times, and I suspect this is me moving around the UK quite a lot.
Yes.
I said on the last podcast, I think I said scone, and nobody's got to me yet. So I'll see how long I can get away with it.
Yes, I think the issue is one, for people who say scone, then hearing somebody say scone, which sounds so middle class, darling, it's just easy to mock straight away. A scone? What are you talking about? Yeah, that's one that comes up so much. Absolutely, yeah.
Actually, you touched on something there that I'd like to insert a pillar of Britishness, if I may, which is the class system.
Yes.
What is James Bond? Is he upper class? Is he upper middle class? What is class?
It's an interesting one. Yeah, it's an interesting one, because it's weird. I've come from a very middle-class background, and when I went to university, I saw most pride in class was from people who considered themselves working class. And there's somebody who, one of my very good friends, East Ender of London, essentially, and he would always bang on about being working class and how his father was working class and all that sort of thing. And I'd never really considered any sort of pride in the class system before that. I think the barriers and the definitions are starting to become a bit more blurred as time goes on. And I think the huge gulfs between, you know, middle class, upper middle class and higher class, I think they're getting a bit more, you know, coagulated, for want of a better phrase. I'd say Bond overall, I'd imagine, is upper middle, because he's quite fancy. He's got, obviously, in the books, I'd say absolutely he's upper middle class. He's got the background. He's got the heritage. I would say just purely his line of work and his attitude towards certain things prevents him from being upper class. But yeah, it's such a strange one overall, because it's something that's so noticeable but is never really discussed. It used to be discussed a lot, but as time's gone on, it's now something that doesn't really come up. And I don't know if that's because I'm surrounded by people who are of a similar class to me, or if it's because I'm dense, or if it's because it's just becoming less of an issue. It's a real strange one, because I know in the past people used to have huge hang-ups about it. And I think the biggest one, well, the most recent one that comes to mind, would be the miners' strikes against Thatcher in the late 80s, early 90s, I think. But yeah, that was where the divide was huge. And since then, I feel like there's not really been a standout moment like that since.
You went back and said that there's certain attitudes that Bond had that meant that he couldn't be upper class. I'm kind of curious what those are.
I think, first of all, his line of work, the fact he's killing people, probably doesn't help. He's the womanizing aspect, I feel like, would be part of it. Because he's not very prim and proper when it comes to that regard. And I think sort of his attitudes towards, not only towards women, but his attitudes with women is probably one of the standout features. I'd say that would define it in a way. I think also the gambling aspect, the alcoholism aspect. And again, yeah, as I've said, I think the line of work would be the biggest standout. Because of course you do get the gentleman spy aspect. But I think that would prevent him from being truly upper class.
Fair enough. And people often identify, you know, Brits as gentlemen. The Chinese word for gentleman is, in fact, gentleman. They just take it straight as that. It's often thought to be a British thing. It's funny, we do associate it so much with James Bond, you know. Gambling, alcoholic, sleeps around, but he is a gentleman.
Exactly. Yeah, it's the aspect of gentlemanism in Britain is always fascinating. Because it's so ingrained. It's like it's what's written on the toilet. It's ladies and gentlemen. And that's how people greet crowds, that sort of thing. It's interesting how that's always been ingrained. And it's like, I guess in some aspects, I imagine foreign people probably expect it in some instances.
Yes. Yeah, I'd say so. Where do you think that comes from? What is this gentleman thing?
I think because some of our biggest exports, not only in media, but in books, have been people who are men who are gentlemen. And I think it's because it stands out way more to consider the army guys who are talking as, hey, it'll all be over by Christmas, that sort of thing. I think that's such a standout in that time to everyone else going through the war that it became almost the stereotype. Because I know pre-World War One and pre-World War Two, the British people weren't exactly looked on favourably, should we say, internationally. I think as time has gone on, and because it's been successful for media, for books, for that sort of thing, I think just because there's been so much of it is now what is expected of British people. Because you see the similar accents on TV. I think I'm going to have to say it's the media side of things.
Do you think it's good PR?
Yeah. Oh, it's fantastic PR, yeah. It works out beautifully. Yeah, I think it's just because because some of the attitudes of being a gentleman, like we were talking about earlier, the stiff upper lipness, the accents, all that sort of thing. Some of the attitudes of being a gent are things that we carry with us unintentionally.
Ah, interesting. So what have we got so far? We've got humour. We've got the class system. We've got gentlemanliness. We've got accents, for sure.
Yes, definitely. Yeah, I think like it's an interesting one. One that I'd like to discuss with you, actually, because I think one that's been diminishing recently. British people were always known for having a huge sense of being hugely patriotic. And I'm saying this whilst wearing my Union Jack socks. But I do feel like it's something that has been watered down over the years. I feel like I'd meet lots of people my generation who aren't particularly, like, they aren't overly patriotic. I know quite a few people who can give less of a damn about the flag and that sort of thing. And it's interesting because I very proudly say I'm British. I'm very happy to be British. But that's it, essentially. I don't take it any further. Well, I know there's people who define so many parts of their lives of being British overall. And it's such a strange one. It's weird. For me personally, I think that sense, which seems so British, the sense of being so patriotic is definitely watering down.
That is interesting. I think in different times of my life, I did something called peace studies at university, sometimes referred to as hippie studies. I ended up doing my master's in accounting and finance just to overwrite all this. I think there would be people who are absolutely horrified at the idea of being proud in a country or anything like that. But I also was in the naval reserves, I was in the university role, naval units. And so I'd flip between these two environments One half calling me a communist and one half calling me a fascist.
Oh, wow.
completely divergent views on, you know, pride in one's country. And then when, every time I try to look around that to gain some kind of normality, because they're both, you could say them both pretty extreme views. I'd say it's gone up and down, right? So at the Olympics, when it was the London Olympics, suddenly everyone was hugely proud to be British. And there was a point when the gold medal table was actually Yorkshire versus the rest of the world.
Yes.
Very proud moment.
Yeah. It's an interesting one because it's the Olympics was a particularly interesting one because there's, I think it's because as well, because we made the Olympics so British, like we really just crammed in every single reference to every export we've had over the last 200 years. Yes, I think it did bring it out in some people, especially. Definitely.
Yeah. And then I feel it's gone kind of up and down, but perhaps down overall.
Mm. Yeah, it's an intriguing one. I think it's because, obviously, with the sense of being patriotic in the past, there was the fighting for your country, all that sort of thing, that aspect of saying, I'll die for my country, that sort of thing. I feel like we don't need to say that sort of thing anymore. So that's probably why I feel like, since I watched so many old films and so many war films and so many spy films, even Bond says things he does for Queen and country, and there'd be many things I'd do which I wouldn't consider for Queen and country. Like part of my job, I'm not educating for Britain. I'm educating because I enjoy the job and it's very rewarding.
And interesting, if you take, obviously these war films are made a very specific point in time, and it was only a few years before the war, the Oxford Union passed a resolution saying that we will refuse to fight for king and country if it comes to war. So even that generation, which we, you know, the golden generation, just a few years before the war, they were saying absolutely not, we wouldn't do this, which perhaps our current generation would do the same unless it came to it.
Yeah, now being it's hopefully something that we don't have to figure out. Sorry, I tried that again. Something we don't have to find out. But yeah, I can see that completely. It'd be an interesting thing. God, it's Union Jack paraphernalia you get everywhere here. Like, we love things with that flag on it. But I'm not sure if that completely equates to... And it's strange, actually, what points like being patriotic comes through. Because when the football is on, and of course England being primarily a football fanatic country, people hanging the flags from windows, all that sort of thing. You see it for 2 weeks until we inevitably get knocked out in the first round. and then you see it in such weird aspects, but yeah, like the rural part of Britain I grew up, there's still quite a few flagpoles out the front of houses, and quite a few people still do fly the flag, so it's such a weird mix. I think it's very generational. I think the older generations talking about it, there's been times where clearly the thought processes are very different. It's like I know quite a few people who would turn down a knighthood if they're offered. Of course, we're not in any position to ever get a knighthood. but lots of people feel like the idea of becoming a sir or a dame and going through the whole monarchy aspect of it, they don't actually like it at all. And that's actually part of it. I think lots of people, my generation, aren't infatuated with monarchy at all, while lots of people are.
I had a hazy childhood memory of walking down the street and everyone had their St. George's flag out. And then I lived abroad for a very long time. And in the media, you see all kinds of questions about what does the St. George flag really mean? Should we really be celebrating all this stuff? And I started to wonder, was this a real memory? Is this really true? And many, many, many years later, I went back to that small town where I lived. And the Union flags were all out and the St. George's flags were all out. And I took a picture of it just to reassure myself this is a genuine memory, that there are still places where people will hang out the flag from everywhere.
Yeah.
It's not a football thing. It's just the weather's nice. Get the flag out.
One of those things. Oh, weather's nice. Let's take out the flag for a wave.
You don't want it out in the winter. It'll get manky.
Sure, absolutely. Nothing worse than the manky flag.
It seems like we've got some pretty solid pillars of Britishness.
We do. We've managed to prop this up quite well, haven't we?
We have. The only one other point is that Britain is insane for its tea consumption.
Now this is one where I lose my British card here because I don't drink tea.
Oh my goodness.
I don't really do hot drinks. I don't do coffee either. But I live with two people who drink tea as if it's going out of fashion. And there have been crises where the last tea bag has been used and they've had to go to the shop immediately because having no tea in the house is something that we can't possibly bear. And it is insane. As you said, the consumption is huge. And it's working as a teacher, of course, like in the breaks and lunch times. The staff room kettle, I have no idea how that thing has survived as long as it has. But yeah, the tea consumption itself is huge.
I drink coffee myself, although I've just had some ginger tea. But I drink coffee myself, and I had Kane on, who was talking about tea, and he's educating me about tea, and he drinks coffee too. So I was wondering, if is it going out of fashion? The statistics tell me it's still a big British thing, drinking tea.
Yeah, no, I'd say the tea companies here will still be making an absolute shed ton of money. It's still a thing, just popping the kettle on, and it's fascinating to know that lots of cultures don't have kettles. Well, of course, when you think about it, a kettle is primarily basically just for tea and sometimes coffee as well. Like, you can do it in other ways. It's insane. But yeah, overall, in the fact we have, like, you know, bars that sell tea where you can go and have your afternoon tea, that sort of thing, that's still a huge cultural thing. It's still a huge business, as too, to be completely honest. Of course, we've got to break it down to the fact these are money making opportunities. But yeah, the tea culture in Britain is just as big as ever, and this is the one stereotype I'll give about British people. That's absolutely true. Tea consumption, that is 100% true.
I'm curious, if you don't drink tea or coffee much, have you ever been for an afternoon tea?
Oh yes, I've been for afternoon teas, and I can drink a cup of tea. I just don't particularly I just don't frequently.
You just don't live on it.
No, I just don't live on it. It's the sort of thing. If the only time I ever normally have tea is like once a year, I'll just be like, oh, I'll have a cup of tea, just fancy that, but or just afternoon tea, where, you know, going that, you get the scones and the cakes.
But the scones, they're good.
Yeah, got to cover both bases. There's been stories where, like, if there's a particularly big episode of something on TV, they have to surge the energy in places, because as soon as the advert break comes on, everyone goes and turns on the kettle. And there's been power outages because this has all happened at once, because everyone puts it on at the same time. Those sorts of stories baffle my mind completely.
Yeah, that was the 1966 World Cup. Yes. So there was a massive power surge. You need to anticipate this stuff.
That's one thing. Just talking about 66, something I've said to so many people, something that is quintessentially British and is a pillar all by itself, is our inability to let go of the past. We still talk about 66 as if it was yesterday. We still talk about how that's the greatest thing that's ever happened. We still talk about winning both of the world wars frequently. Anything good that's ever happened, we will never, ever. And we still talk about winning Eurovision in 1997.
You mean other people don't?
No, that's what we assume. Like, of course, everybody in Germany is going to be talking about Katrina and the waves in 1997, not about their own personal victories. With sports, it's a huge one as well. Like, the 66 World Cup, the fact that that's still, like, pictures of that are still being sold. There's still documentaries about it, and it's been nearly 60 years later. We've not won anything else in football, so I guess we have to talk about it, but my word.
Don't worry, if we win anything else, we suddenly have a whole new industry of talking about it.
Can you imagine it? Yeah, in the next 60 years, it'll be fantastic. Well, personally, I'm a big Formula One fan, and Lewis Hamilton dominating the sport for the last couple of years has been fantastic. But I know there are people, whoever I talk about F1, they go, oh, Lewis Hamilton. It's going to be, no, there are other people, I promise.
Yeah, we do love our past. I'd say we often love the full range of it, not just victories, but we look at our own defeats as well. Like, one of the greatest British war films is about A Bridge Too Far, and the unpleasant end of it.
I think we're okay with defeats, because overall we came out doing pretty well as a whole, and I think that's the thing, because we're so self-deprecating, to actually acknowledge our defeats is probably quite useful overall. We do tend to skip a little bit of the late 1800s and early 1900s, though. We often skip past that bit.
Apart from the Napoleonic Wars, by Jove.
Yes, of course. I was introducing my 10-year-old kids as part of a history lesson to 1066 the other day. Yeah.
Well, I think that's why we go for 1966 World Cup, because it's such a perfect bookend for 1066 to 1966.
That's it, yeah. That perfect 900 years. It's interesting, actually, because in schools we teach one of the things that's in our policies now, and something we have to teach British values. So lots of that means we do lots of history lessons, for example, and doing Saxons is now coming up and being more of a focus. I'm just going to get up what the British values are, actually. So yeah, schools, that's part of our policy. We want every school to promote the basic British values of democracy, the rule of law, individual liberty, and mutual respect and tolerance for those of different faiths and beliefs. This ensures young people understand the importance of respect and leave school fully prepared for life in modern Britain.
Okay.
But yeah, so that's kind
do,
of...
Do you have any thoughts on this? I'm immediately thinking of the Reformation when we talk about our traditional tolerance for those of different beliefs.
Yes, I feel like it's I feel like they're trying to really bring home the message of, hey, let's make love, not war, that sort of thing.
Worse things in there, I'm sure.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, no, it's an interesting one. It's interesting how those values have been slapped with British in front of it. It's like, okay, interesting. We could just say basic values of democracy, rule of law, etc. But to put British in front of it is a very interesting concept, or very interesting idea, at least.
Sure. What do you think of that?
What I think of it overall? I think it could probably be a bit more specific. It's something I found with education. Lots of people say things just because it's the right thing to read down on paper. And when it comes to actually implementing stuff, it's very different. So I feel like here they've got some ideas that they really want to come across. And they're really trying to promote. And they're just saying, I feel like they've worded it in a way to make it sound ultra nice, ultra fancy in a way. And I think it probably needs a bit more of a deep dive in certain aspects completely.
It does sound like something that's very hard to argue against in principle, but also quite hard to argue for.
Yes, it's kind of just there, really, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm not sure where you can go with it. I was wondering how would parents react. I imagine the parents don't react to it at all.
No, exactly. They read it, and I feel like on some instances, as soon as they finish reading it, they've forgotten that they've read it.
Yeah. Yeah, there's not another thing for my kid to bring to school or anything like that I could forget.
I don't have to make anything for it, so it's fine. But yeah, I feel like it's there to tick the boxes. So if someone says, oh, but what about your values of democracy? It's like, we've got this policy here that ensures we teach it under the rule of Britishness. So I feel like it's just kind of ticking boxes, basically. I think those sorts of things, yeah, it's kind of weird that some of it has to actually be listed out, because some of those things you'd expect just... And you just expect by itself. I feel like having to recognise that the fact is unacceptable to dismiss people's beliefs or opinions. That should be something that's expected of somebody. You shouldn't have to write that down.
And I'm just hearing the voice from Yes Minister of Bernard saying, red tape binds this country together.
Yeah, absolutely. That is something that would have come out straight out of Yes Minister.
Yeah. Mm. Okay. I feel we've... I think we've fleshed out pretty well.
Quite a bit of detail into our British pillars. I'm sure the British pillars will be red, white and blue too.
All the Americans in my office, I love to wear the red, white and blue and say, you know what, I'm wearing these colours because I love Russia.
Fantastic. Oh, I love that. Oh, dear.
Okay. Then I think it's time for me to say, Chris, thank you so much for joining me. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Oh, brilliant. Well, thank you very much for having me on. Honest to be honest, it's been great to have the chat with you.
And, of course, we can all find you at British Bond Addict.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's great. That's my only thing's on Instagram. That's basically, I don't really have any other social media aspects like that.
It's a good way to be. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you. Oh, it's such a tough one.